welcome to our new Mick Artistics Ego podcast. We'll be bringing you chat, insight, nonsense, laughter, music, and a few surprises. And you can find out about our current activities, gigs, release news at mickartistic.com and on Facebook at Mick Artistics Ego Trip, as well as plenty of footage on our YouTube channel. And you can follow us on Twitter at Mick Artistic and at Johnny Ego Trip and at Ego Trip News. Welcome to podcast number 4. And today's guests are Gavin Turk and Deborah Curtis. Gavin Turk is an artist. He's a contemporary of Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin. Deborah Curtis works in community education and runs the project The House of Fairy Tales. And in today's podcast, we'll be talking about very expensive tulips, the power of Pete, the birth of hip hop, and managing as a married couple with art projects and childcare. For those of you that don't know who Gavin Turk is, he'll explain now for 20 minutes, and Deborah Curtis will also explain as well who she is. And I'll just sit here.
And the 20 minutes starts now.
Now.
Start your watches. I think I'd rather not, actually, just go straight into a 20-minute ramble on who I am.
Okay, fine, right, fine. Well, we won't do that then. We'll just ignore that last question. Gavin Turk is not very good at geography. He fails.
I think it was you. I think it was your fault.
Well, it's probably we're both poor at geography.
I think that the trouble is that round here, round these parts, the geography is really, like, not very interesting, and all the landmarks are really similar and repetitive.
Yeah.
So when I say to you, head for the pylon, you go, oh, there's the pylon, and head off for the other pylon.
Yeah, because there's nothing like kind
one
of the...
One pylon looks quite like another pylon, doesn't it?
Unfortunately, I should have said the big pylon rather than the smaller pylon.
Yeah.
But you need both.
We just need we need a pub, we need something like kind of the Rustler's Arms, or just past Wendings, the funeral directors, but there's nothing like that there. So it was just a case of pylon or scaffolding or flyover. Go under that, the left flyover.
When I say go under the flyover, I don't mean go under the flyover again, because you've already gone underneath it.
Yeah. Anyway, it was. I turned up in a lather, and my jacket is now in the dryer getting dried, and I've got a painting jacket on, which I may appropriate. I'm going back to Leeds. I've got it's got a badge on it, and I'll have to kind of scribble that out and put Mick Artistic on the top. Yeah, officially. Gavin Turk, he's an artist, and he's a mischief maker, and he loves rock, and he loves dressing up
a bit.
What are you doing at the moment, Gavin?
I think, like most of us, I think I'm having a kind of turning inside out experience with the whole lockdown, or coming out of lockdown, or trying to understand what the hell's gone on, or where we are, or what we are. And I've been really having to kind of figure out what's important again. I mean, I think I'm always trying to think about what's important, but this gives you a slightly shifted context where what's important slightly changes. And yeah, I think I have kind of gone inside more and started to try and deal with my own sense of context. And I was really, and have been really interested and excited by the whole Black Lives Matter taking down sculptures story.
Uh-huh.
Because, well, really, up until recently, I was definitely of the mindset where I thought, oh no, you shouldn't take down sculptures. You should leave the sculptures there and just put up good signage, put up good notices around these sculptures.
Information about it. To put it in context.
To put it in context. But now I'm thinking, why don't we? Why don't we change our history? Like, history is just something that, and people say it all the time, history is written by the winners. well, why don't we just be a winner and write the history that we want, write a history that's suitable? And we know at the moment, you know, with the gender politics and racial politics, actually history's being rewritten. People from history, like who we didn't know about, are being brought up to our attention and being reinserted back into history. Yeah. So history's changing. Yeah. It's not a fixed thing. And history is something that we can use to help us go into the future. So if we correct our history in a way,
this is a perfect
we're
time
getting
to...
ourselves into a better position to go forwards. So, and I think to myself, well, actually, yeah, let's pull the sculptures down, put them in, put the sculpture which was standing over the doorway of the museum, you know, celebrating Jeffrey or whoever it is, like some slave trader who made, you know, inappropriate amounts of money, and put them inside the museum and then tell the story. I mean, the first time I went to Moscow, I went to the Tretyakov Museum. And in the gardens outside the museum, there's all these columns lying down with Stalin sculptures on them. And they're just all lying down and all over the place. It's like a weird sort of like pickup sticks or something with these sculptures. And it was like no one or no body, no state presence or anything. There was no power. People didn't have the power to lift these sculptures up. There wasn't enough metal or human ingenuity or money or whatever it is. No power to lift these sculptures up. No one wanted them lifted up. So they were just lying around. We couldn't throw them away, but they were just lying down. And it said so much. It sort of like really was a powerful statement of what a sculpture, what public,
and I started
thinking about sculpture as well, like, and art outside. I mean, as a practitioner, you know, like obviously most of the people that are pulling sculptures down, they're not artists. We, you know, the artists are there trying to putting sculptures up. But I was really thinking, like, wow, you know, this is a whole new mindset for me. Like the idea that a sculpture is, you know, it's not forever, or it needn't be forever.
It's not for Christmas.
I mean, yeah. It could be for Christmas,
take it down, smash it,
like
on the epiphany on the January the 6th at the end of, you know, smash.
I was just thinking about like the Van Doon Museum, because we did a project with the Van Doon Museum, which became, I'm now introducing myself.
This is Deborah Curtis here. She just stuck her oar in.
We worked together on a project.
We've been sort of in Amsterdam. In a sort of a shared track for 30 years, isn't it? And it's quite interesting being in a kind of a romantic relationship with someone, and then a working relationship with someone, and then actually have totally different approach to life and the universe, and somehow learn how to make that work. So I've always been very interested in community and politics and how the world gets put together, and we've gone on very many trips to other countries and other cities where Gavin has been kind of they're invited maybe to have an exhibition, and we go and do a kind of trip around all the art museums, sometimes with kids in tow, sometimes not, and then we go around all the resources for young people and children and look at kind of how education works in other countries. And I think that shared journey has led to where we are today. One of the moments where our two practices came together in a sort of slightly kind of strange way was at the Van Loon Museum in Amsterdam, where we were invited by our friend Philippa, who's the descendant of her ancestors who set up the Dutch East India Company, which basically kind of created the wealth of Europe.
Yeah.
Or they were very key players in the creation of the wealth of Europe. And that she's somehow inherited from her father the responsibility for this house in Amsterdam, which is a kind of he was an archaeologist, and he turned this house into a sort of archaeological memoriam up to the family. So it had all a collection, which during the war it all got scattered, but he collected up bits of furniture, bits of family trees, portraits, things that had gone far and wide, and he put it all back into this house. And then she inherited this family history and had to somehow, like, kind of live with it, like some awkward reminder of something that maybe she'd prefer to forget.
Mm.
And her response to it was to invite... She'd actually met Gavin at Chelsea School of Art, so she's an artist, practising artist, and she decided that she'd invite artist friends that she's known over the years, and many that she hasn't known, to come and respond to the family collection. So she's invited Asian artists and African artists to come and respond to this family history, which has involved exploitation,
blood,
and
death,
and theft,
slavery,
and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really interesting and brave way of dealing with it, because they would then sort of be put in a place of power within that story.
Yeah.
And to respond to something which actually the did not feel like something that should just be kind of erased or destroyed. It felt like something that was worth building on and adding to and exploring in a different way. And when Gavin was invited to come and respond to it, I went across for fun. Actually, our daughter was living there, so we sort of went to kind of sort of.
So how many children have you got?
We are three, two are not in the UK right now, so I don't know what that says about us. But,
are they old? Are they old children? Are they like
the
20s, teenage?
25.
26.
Okay.
26,
25 and 19. So they're kind of, we're responding to this. Well, Gavin is being invited to respond to this collection. I'm kind of like catching up with our friend and sort of experiencing Amsterdam and sort of thinking about kind of what's going on at the corner of my eye, like what he's talking about. And he sort of suggests bringing the packaging of a bunch of tulips, which he started to explore what it means to put a kind of a floral display inside a museum, and what the tulip as a symbol of Dutch history means, and he chooses to represent that through the cardboard box that they got delivered in, like some guy has just...
Oh, I saw that,
But then he kind of casts it in bronze and paints it in... And he was saying, I'm going to put that in the hallway. And I said, is that it? And he's going, because I want it to be really like kind of, you know, difficult for people to deal with. And I'm going, it's so difficult, people were just going to walk past it. And I'm
difficult, and it wasn't difficult at all.
I mean, and it will be powerful for people who are looking for it, but if people are not looking for it, they'll... And so I'm sort of thinking about how to engage people a little bit more than this, because I feel like, maybe I work too hard or something,
but also they were Turkish tulips, and not only are they Turkish because they come from me.
Just saying, there was nothing wrong with your idea. I was thinking from the point of the engagement of the audience. And so the more he talked about his idea, the more I got interested in it, the more I kind of started
thinking
about the history.
This is interesting, because I saw the image for the first time this morning, and to me it was like, it's a well replicated flower box, and it's quite intriguing. Turkish tulips, I think. Yeah. But all this stuff about
we
should have a big.
We ended up putting together
somebody standing there.
The context.
It might look like
this might look rubbish, but it's actually really good.
Come here. Let me tell you.
What happened was we ended up like kind of doing some weird collaboration between the children's arts charity that we set up, which is called the House of Fairy Tales, and Gavin's work, and it became a kind of curated show or centered around the tulip, and explored the history of the Middle East and Europe through the metaphor of the tulip, and it became an education program, and we did it in schools in the UK.
Is the tulip,
so it ended up becoming kind of something very different to the original kind of purpose of placing an artwork provocation in a family collection, which I felt was a little bit too light. It wasn't really taking on the history in enough of a kind of like, oh. like a
it was
you
heavy.
Know,
It was very heavy.
It was very, very heavy.
But I think it's that thing of interpretation, and it and comes back to that idea of context. Like, what is the signage? What is the context? And how much you need to spell it out? And how much does the story of the art, how much is it all contained in the art? I mean, quite often it isn't contained in the art. The artist has put it in there, but then they just put it into a museum. And sometimes it can be a bit high and dry as an audience. As an audience, you go into a gallery and you go, "Oh, what is that?
What does it mean?
How does it work? I mean, not that art has to mean. I mean, we all get into a bit of a trap where we think art has to mean stuff, like specific mean stuff. And that's also because people have conceptualized art and have said it means this, it means that. You can look at it like this, you can look at it like that. And if you don't, then you're not engaging with it properly. But in actual fact, like sometimes art means... Deborah's just arrived with the Hofft Examiner. It's a newspaper that was published with the story of the tulip.
It's got the history, it's got everything in it. I'll just show you what's got in it. It's got where wild tulips grow, which is along the 40th parallel, which is a particular line of latitude that goes around the planet, which has a temperature that supports the tulip plant. I sometimes wonder whether the tulips don't cultivate humans, actually, rather than
I just had tulips in Amsterdam, I didn't know that.
And then this is all about the trade routes of between the Middle East and Europe when the original traders were going across,
the
and they were the Silk Road, and they were kind of like starting to kind of bring back interesting objects they put in there. That ends up with a horrible picture of a shipping container with about 50 million like Lego bricks of shipping containers on it.
Yeah.
Then there's an introduction to the Iranian and the Ottoman empires, kind of getting you excited about the extraordinary wealth of knowledge and intellectual amazing stuff that we've somehow kind of inherited from. The Arabic world which is something we've somehow forgotten in our contemporary ideas of terrorism. And then there's a kind of a whole thing about Persia and sultans and thinking about kind of like what that history is all about. And then we've got what the Persians have done for us, you know, as a country.
Oh, look at that two blue pages. Oh, look at that.
And then we've got tulips in Europe.
It's a beautiful page.
And we've got the kind of the whole thing about the tulip mania, which was the kind of insane beginning of capitalism, where people were paying the price of a house for the promise of a tulip, because it was just a certificate that says that when that tulip grows, you can have the crop from that little bit of land, which is not very much. And then you've got
the tulip was a very valuable flower, there was this thing tulip mania
like, and for like 2 or 3 years it just went crazy in Amsterdam and around the Netherlands, and people were just paying like ridiculous. They were selling their house to buy tulips. I mean,
so when was this?
1640.
Yeah, so it was like but it was a bubble. It was literally like a bubble.
There's a lecture on it in that film, The Wolf of Wall Street.
All right.
He's got a picture of the Dutch cult. You know,
they're always talking about in the art newspapers and in the media, they were talking about the art bubble as well, like all the auction houses and the idea that people are valuing art, which valuing it way above
what it should be.
There's a fly interrupting the interview here. Look,
yeah,
it's a pink fly.
It looks like a tulip.
He's trying to get on the mic.
So we've got Deborah, we've got Gavin, we've got Mick, and we've got the fly.
And the fly.
He's getting nothing.
It's our attempt at responsible composting. We got a bit carried away during lockdown, and now we've got lots of flies.
Right.
And we've got lots of compost.
Yeah.
And we've got a garden now. We didn't have a garden before.
So do you both work here? Both work in this? You have your own space? Deborah's room, and you've got Gavin's.
Well, we've actually got the room with my end and Deborah's end.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
So it's an open plan office.
She sort of put a bookshelf up in the middle a bit. Yeah.
She's not got as much room as you.
She's not got quite as much room as me.
It's the same in our house. Yeah. You know, but we have rows about sort of space, sort of sharing. How come you got all that big room there? And this is my house, my partner says. This is my house and I have that little box room there. How did that happen?
I just redistribute the wealth, you see. I just spend it on doing creative education projects with schools.
I just basically make objects and try and sell them to really wealthy wealthy collectors. Yes, I just make objects and sell them to wealthy collectors at very high prices, and then Deborah benefits from the profit by sharing it in education projects for children. And in fact, that's how we know you, because I think we met you originally because we were taking the House of Fairy Tales round various festivals.
Tell us about the House of Fairy Tales. What's
the House
that?
Of Fairy
Tell
Tales.
Us about the House of Fairy Tales.
I think Deborah should do the House of Fairy Tales introduction, because if I do it, she looks at me with dagger eyes, going "You're not doing it any justice. You're doing it wrong."
Right.
So
whoever, just
Deborah,
lob it. If you need to interrupt.
I might have to do dagger eyes. I might have to do dagger eyes on her in a minute.
She can tell lockdown's been fun.
Come on, House of Fairy Tales.
The House of Fairy Tales.
The House of Fairy Tales is. I mean, where it's going next is a sort of part two. But where it's been up till now has been this strange PhD for me in kind of learning about education through practice based work, which has been highly collaborative and creating children's adventures with lots of amazing, brilliant people who do extraordinary work with young people, and kind of watching these adventures and how young people respond to being in a very high density of playful adults, and how extraordinary that is.
But how do you do that? I mean, how do you demonstrate that? I mean, if I'm the podcast audience, and I go, oh, well, what is the House of Fairy Tales? And I listen to this podcast,
it's
when I go away,
it's a space where adults love to play and be excited and curious and interested in about the world and what the possibilities are, and they kind of tell that we get the adults to be in that play space through a kind of shared narrative with each event or each exhibition or each thing we do. There's a kind of a strong central narrative thread, and then all the different artists kind of respond to that narrative thread. Not dissimilar to this tulip idea, but basically we'll have a story that often it becomes a kind of parallel universe story. So it's like a story about a kind of an alien who lives on a faraway planet who wants to know how to grow gardens, and has seen them through the telescope, and on this strange blue jewel of a planet has spotted that there's these extraordinary green gardens, and they want to know how to create those. So then we get the young people to. That's the Clockwork Garden. That was one of the projects.
Did you have something like Noel Fielding telling a story or something?
Noel Fielding came and sort of bought some art from us, and then sort of got very interested in kind of like how he might put some art in the kind of exhibitions that we were doing to raise money. We had Grayson Perry telling stories as Claire. So he was telling stories to the children in his frock.
So what are the adults?
Scaring the adults.
So what are the adults? Are the adults running around, kind of tigging each other, or are they sort of doing like hopscotch,
parents?
This space. What do people do? What do people of 50-year-old do?
They're kind of doing all kinds of different things, from theatre to science experiments to magic to engineering. Like experiments with ecology and horticulture. I've got Whitehead, who's basically kind of he thinks he can transform the world through camouflage, because he's got this kind of whole way of thinking about humans and nature, and thinking about like how to torn camouflage around away from the army and the kind of military, and back into this idea of how you kind of. You work with nature rather than against her. So he does lots of kind of like strange experiments with camouflage.
Yeah.
And we have like just a bunch of, I mean, hundreds of people that we've worked with. So
do the adults and children work together, or is it like separate?
It's an adult play thing, is it? Because there are, you can't, I mean, quite often people are in costume, but we do welcome everybody to come and play. So in the events that are in the public space, I mean, obviously it's different in different contexts. So if we're in schools, we encourage the teachers to play as much as possible, because that's how they'll learn how to also be more in that mode themselves. It's quite interesting how it works with adults, because actually sometimes they'll find and remember their playful side in a way, and their curious side and their investigative side that they haven't maybe accessed for
a long time,
decades. Yeah. And you know, like it's the children and young people that are trying to drag their dad away from that workshop because they want to get to the next one. You know, they're kind of saying like, "Come on, Dad," and he's like, "I haven't finished. I want to finish my drawing." And you know, you get those moments where you think we really do, like, somehow
you can stop
crush
being
it
dad.
Out of people. Yeah, we crush it out of people. Yeah. And I think it's sort of like one of the reasons why we're in where we are today, like in this moment in history, where we very much are staring in the face of life on Earth no longer being here, like through the activity of the human. You start realizing how, you know, it's got to start at education, because if you can carry on being that kind of playful, curious, like fun loving kind of, you know, that every young child that you meet is that, and you know, slowly as you get older, there's something that gets lost in many of you know, I would say a majority of the population, where they stop finding their curiosity and their playfulness, because somehow the world becomes so serious.
They get out of practice. They get out of practice.
I mean, I'm not saying that I'm like always practicing what I preach. I sometimes, you know, find myself worn down by the cares of the world and find my curious side has kind of atrophied, and I have to kind of remember. Gavin is a, you know, an amazing person to live with, because I think he's never lost it, and it's like he's in that.
I think you do it too. Because you like to try. You like to try something that you haven't done before, and some of it is like, oh, I'm just going to do this because I haven't tried it before. But some of it's because you want to surprise yourself, and then you find it surprising, and then you are surprised, and then you go, oh, I'm going to share that. Oh, I'm going to take that out on the road. That's going to be part of my set because it surprised me. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you, it sets you out as a stimuli.
Of course, no, it does. It's whatever.
And I genuinely think and believe that if every human like was to be in that mode of being in the present and in the now and more in that kind of like space of curiosity, it didn't matter what role they have in society or what their kind of way of being. Like
the
within
shackles,
the community,
the shackles,
they would
of whatever,
be free.
The,
they would be free to be themselves, and that's my mission.
the egg race,
the great egg race.
Yeah. So, but I think I for the last year and a half we've been doing less activity that out in the world and looking at how to plan this bigger proposal for schools, which is called the Great Imagining. And we're launching it in October in the education community, and it's about getting schools to take 2 weeks of a syllabus and a curriculum to kind of to invent this whole possibility of what the future might be like if we can create a sustainable regenerative future, not a future that's inevitably leading to apocalypse. That's
going to
be fun, isn't it?
Right. That was Deborah Curtis and Gavin Turk on What's My Life? Wonderful. So so what brings you the pairing? What brings you comfort during this period? You know, I've got things like music, silence, phone calls to friends, work. So is it what is kind of helping you in this state that we're in, this bubble? What are you finding yourself reaching for more?
Gardening
know?
Me.
It's gardening for you.
Love cooking.
Yeah.
All right. Another one. What are you doing that during this lockdown that has surprised you? That you found yourself doing something? Gosh, sewing buttons.
Was doing drawings. Like, I think I started on the 10th of March when the kind of lockdown started in the studio. And because we don't live very far away from here, we were able to go on our bikes from home to here and here to, this was our, you know, our bubble. Nicely kind of involved the studio and the home.
Bigger bubble.
It's a big, long, weird.
We're all in bubbles.
We had Sarita with us as well. So she and our son Caesar. So the four of us would cycle on the canal each day and go and work in the studio and then cycle back.
But what I think for me, I started doing a drawing. So I started doing a drawing on the 10th of November, and I did that all the way up until the end of July. Like every day I would do a drawing, the point of the drawing as well wasn't to set up any subject. So it was supposed to be subjectless, whatever that means. And obviously, you know, like as you're doing stuff, you start getting all kind of conscious of all sorts of things, whether it's the pencil or the bit of paper or the relationship between the two lines or whether you like that particular line or you don't like that line, or which bit of this do you like, which bit do you don't like. Like, and if I do more of this, oh no, now it's gone wrong, like I'm doing, and then oh well I'll have to do more of that, I like that bit, so I have to do whatever that is, like however you're judging that. And for me that was sort of a new thing, like I hadn't, it became quite academic in a strange way, because it was supposed to be really like surreal and just like impulsive and just free of the constraints of drawing, normal drawings or what a drawing would be. It was always pencil on paper, but it was like, you know, when it started out as a blank piece of paper, here we go, we don't know what it is, it could be anything, we make it up as we do it. But in the end, like weirdly enough, obviously you start like, and because it becomes something that you're doing like every day, almost like mechanically, suddenly you start thinking and suddenly you start noticing, suddenly you start looking and suddenly you start realizing stuff. And that actually was quite an interesting, it was like, I suppose it was like keeping a diary, which I don't normally do. I think that actually moved me on somewhere. Now I'm now like at this point where I've stopped doing the drawings like this month, and I'm kind of, I feel like something's missing. Like I might have to go back to doing them.
You might have to do something else.
But I might have to do something else, exactly. Yeah. I might just do something else. But I think, interestingly, in terms of like comfort or like that idea of comfort, which you use the word comfort. Mm. I in a way, I think I'm just, when I'm doing and when I'm in a process of kind of unfettered thinking, that I find comfort in that. I find there's some comfort in just almost like it's like that creative space. And I think for me, like if I'm busy doing something like driving a car, listening to the radio, I have like this, like sometimes I have all my best kind of art ideas like suddenly are coming in. And I'm like, what's happening? Like, because it's almost like your conscious brain is busy doing stuff, and then you get this other bit where you kind of are more, you're more sort of subconscious, but you're aware of it and you're able to get it, you're able to get hold of it.
Is there a lot of ideas coming in this kind of time?
Yeah.
Do you feel like oh my God, I want to, you know.
I think there's a lot of ideas. There's also, like, as I was saying before, with this realisation with the sculptures as well. Like, I do really get a strong sense and a feeling of impact. Like, what is my impact on the world? Like, what am I taking? What am I using? How is the me being me, affecting the world in its own small little way? And how is my human nature, like when you amplify that like to 7.6 billion like people on the planet, like how is that actually working? How does that work out?
Physical material as well as intellectual.
Yeah, and in all senses, of the kind of economy of being, the economy of life, like how does being alive use stuff? How is it using up materials? How is it working with what's around it?
I had a brief look at that Michael Landy's breakdown book again this morning. And it's like, Michael Landy's this artist, a friend of ours, who's like a really amazing person, I don't know how long ago it was, but like decided to take every single possession, everything in his life and put it all through the grinder.
Oh, yeah.
As an art project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was so ahead of its time, we're all in that space right now where do we want to actually make anything else physical, really? I'm not sure. Also while we were on lockdown, we did a whole series of and we are still doing them, kind of street gatherings, where we call them doorstep concerts, and I think they were actually happening like in little pockets all over the country, but like we just did it spontaneously in our street the first time, and then we liked it and we kept doing it. And actually,
I think it started with going out on your doorstep and doing a clap for the NHS.
No, it was to do with it was
Bill Withers. We always sang Bill Withers. Didn't we? Lean on Me.
One of the things, yeah.
We did that on the street. Like everyone on the street came out their doors and all sang together. Bill Withers.
We created little booklets with all the lyrics to all the different songs we were going to sing.
So was the kind of a guitars and our recordings involved and stuff?
Like playing the instruments.
So right the way down, this long orchestra
people would take it in turns to do a bit of the curation and we'd always make a little booklet, a pamphlet. The other day when we're doing them less often now because we were doing them every week, but the other day when we did one, we got Giles to come and do storytelling. Giles Abbott, fantastic storyteller. And I realised that, you know, because there's not been any theatre for such a long time, to actually have somebody who is actually professionally, his profession is to hold an audience through storytelling.
Yeah.
For him to be on one side of the street in the kind of like the bit where you park the cars, and then this whole load of people
on the audience on the other side of the street.
Every so often a delivery car would come by, so he had to sort of like pause for a second or make some little kind of joke interaction with the delivery guy. But basically kind of that it was this it was a real feeling of like we're going back into medieval times where actually that's the kind of
the way
we are gonna be going back into that space. And it's really powerful and amazing.
Yeah, I was in Leeds in the city centre on Briggate, and there was a fellow across the street from me, this dumpy young man of about 35 with a sound system and a microphone, and he was belting out Angels and Don't Look Back in Anger and Mr. Brightside. And I stood there and I was riveted. I had about sort of, you know, and I've still got Angels going on in my head. I had about 4 days, you know. Yeah. Through it all, she offers me protection, you know. And I stood there and I watched this guy, and he had like an audience, like four or five 14-year-old girls who were like these little girls. They were standing sort of opposite top, and they were like singing. They were singing along to Mr. Brightside, and they were just. Because he had a microphone,
we've always had buskers, but it's become it was in many ways only just socially acceptable, and occasionally the somebody would grant a like permission for somebody to stand somewhere or whatever. Like, but actually, now I think that we people are in such a
we're starved.
They're missing. They're missing it.
I had tears in my eyes. Yeah, basically, yeah. I was welling up and to this questionable music, but I was saying, go on, lad, go on. And I clapped him. I was clapping him after every song. And there was my partner and my daughter. And my daughter sings in a kind of a funk function band. And she was all Gloria Gaynor and Beyonce. She's standing next to me. And I was trying not to cry. I was going, my God. And it was so, it was, I was realized I was parched of having a 5'7", 5'8" person in front of me, kind of coming, giving it in my direction. I'm thinking, what I've won, you know, this is so important. So important to have real live people in front of you. Just letting go, because it could go wrong. It's just it's just the fact that it, you don't know what's going to happen.
I thought there was really amazing Zoom experiences though. Like, I don't know if you had any, like, but I was.
So well, we started doing something called Zoom chats. Who's Zooming who? Aretha Franklin. We played that at one of our doorstep parties. No, but suddenly everyone was Zoom, and everyone was in WhatsApp. WhatsApp groups, or in Jamaica, I think it's called Wagwan groups. WhatsApp groups, so things are being shared through WhatsApp groups. This is a whole new thing. We all got, I think one of the things that happened during the whole kind of virus situation is that everybody's got kind of stuck in, zoomed into their screens. The screens have become really dominant. And in the art world, you know, lots of exhibitions, and people were going to do exhibitions. There's lots of exhibitions coming up, so much promises. So the art world looks sort of like really exciting. Suddenly, like, all the shows were cancelled and they were just put online, you know.
I actually think there's something really great about that as well, because there's exhibitions that I've seen over the last few months that I would never have gone to see or would have seen, and I've actually kind of like learned some stuff about some artists and some exhibitions, some experiences that I think would only have happened because people had bothered to put it online. I think there's something very generous about the accessibility of that.
I didn't know they were having exhibitions on Zoom. I mean, all I knew was that
not really on Zoom, online.
Just online. Where they film the kind of space, and then you can actually.
A little bit.
But they, you know, like there was again, like there was that Arthur Jaffa thing that the Tate put out, and they really advertised it, and so it was like something that you'd normally see in a museum, like a video artwork, which was just then available for any audience, like to, you know, for anyone who's what was interested to go and see this thing.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Which is brilliant because I think that there is something about the rarefied space of those high end experiences, which is quite exclusive and is you know, obviously the whole hashtag Black Lives Matter thing's been massive as well, and that's been I've been doing quite a lot of thinking and reading and discovering and working out. I've got this brilliant document called White Supremacy Culture that was published by a website called Dismantling Racism, I think it's called dismantlingracism.org. It's very good, you can download it. And it's kind of like a step-by-step guide to how institutions and organisations and cultures set up spaces which are impermeable to people from the outside. And, you know, it's called white supremacy culture, but you could call it, like, you know, class supremacy culture, or you call it, like, gender supremacy culture, whatever you want to call it. Like, there's any ways of thinking about this stuff, but it's about how the institution itself makes it very difficult for people to penetrate
to
it
through,
and kind of
come
into it. Mm. Even within an organisational structure, you know, the first paragraph is called perfectionism, which is a really challenging one, because actually I'm a terrible perfectionist. And so you kind of realise that you're actually self-sabotaging yourself when you become like too perfectionist about stuff. I think that's something that I really respond to you about, because I'm pointing to Mick now, like,
gesture,
and to some extent Gavin,
gesture,
like, which is
throwing your hands,
because you're not perfect,
because
in any
because
respect.
You will you'll celebrate and you'll find the humor and the playfulness in improvised mistakes or accidents or something that comes back from the audience or the sort of the mundanity of daily existence, or something which you know, it's kind of anti-perfectionism philosophy.
Well, the thing is, I am really, really kind of quite perfectionist in
and
I get very, very upset about it. Has to be my button has to be just right.
Yeah.
A little decal,
what
they call
it. Right paper bag.
I had the right. This will do. This works. But then I find I get accidents happen and somebody throws me an overall, and I think that works. You know, somebody says, it does work because you're wearing it. And,
no, but you have a grace within that.
Yeah, no,
you have a generosity to yourself as well as the audience. Like I've seen you get to that point of have a kind of moment of bewilderment come over your face, and then there's a sort of cheeky grin, and there's a kind of like a smirk, and suddenly you find the funny side.
Yeah,
and
or I find control, or I think, oh yeah, no, I know where I am, but I don't know why, but I feel okay.
It's a good place
for me. It's a good place. That's the perfect place for me to be. But I couldn't be on stage like 24/7 because I have to get on with this stuff. I have to do podcasts.
I also think you're the hardest working man in show business. I've seen you do about 15 gigs in one festival.
So they're always saying it, aren't they?
And you're all advertised as well.
But it just sounds so sort of leaden and lumpen.
Yeah.
The hardest working man in show business.
The joy of it. You love it. And so does the audience.
Showbiz.
and so does your fans, because they follow you around. We've been to 3 in one weekend.
Yeah,
something like that.
Three gigs in one weekend.
Too many of them.
And we didn't even see all of them.
And loving the repeats. Fox at the bottom of the garden. Yay!
Did you do Port Elliot regularly? You
know, yeah, yeah. And
was that like every year?
No, but also coming back to Port Elliot, that was actually because of Jago Elliot, like. The sort of the son and heir who unfortunately died.
Yeah.
He, in a way, it was his invitation to get us to do the tent, to get us to organise an area in the at Port Elliot, like that set up that started the House of Fairy Tales. So the House of Fairy Tales starts at Port Elliot. And it's almost like in honour of Jago Elliot.
That's what you brought to Port Elliot. That's what you were booked to do.
Yeah. We were being invited from the first one when it first started. Flocky was working with Simon Prosser and our friends were working together, and one was doing the literary stuff and the other one was doing the art stuff. And so Gavin was being invited as an artist, and then she said, "Oh, Deb, you do these amazing kids stuff, like, so can we do one of those?" And I said, "No way, it's in the middle of the summer holidays, and that would involve like a van, a couple of vans and a coach of people, and I'm not doing that in the middle of my summer holidays." And then 3 years later, there I am with the coach, kind of a couple of trucks.
But the thing is that it started
as a sort of like slightly kind of subversive revolutionary act, because Jago wanted to sort of like kind of have something which was in the dip of the dell of the Red Dungeon Gardens that could potentially go on all night, and I wanted to bring the children's area into the centre of the festival, and Peregrine Elliot, the master of the domain, had I would say probably with a little bit of tongue in cheek, but had a bit of an attitude of like, you know, seen and not heard. And so he'd put the children's area right down by the river.
Yeah, out of the way.
way out of the way, yeah. Which I thought was A, difficult for families, and B, like, why would you do that? Because young people are so exciting, and the way that you can bring young people into an experience just makes it better for everyone. So we were doing something that was a bit subversive in that first year, and then he went and died, which was a bit of a kind of shocker. And we decided on balance that we should do it anyway as a kind of a kind of place for people to kind of to hold him and his energy and his way of being. Gavin suggested calling it the House of Fairy Tales because he was quite a sort of magical guy and a bit of a storyteller. And somehow the House of Fairy Tales seemed like at the time I thought it was a bit like, oh, that's so unfashionable. And awkward, and like, I don't know.
Yeah,
like, Yeah. And then somehow
it doesn't have a sort of a
like, well, also like I think everyone thinks it's just going to be loads of kids with fairy wings on, and like it isn't really fairy tales in that way.
I thought it was very
I think it's just I was just looking really at this surrealistic possibility of fairy tales, the idea of stories which can just flow in really kind of unexpected ways and do like actually supernatural things. Like the idea that there wasn't really a boundary, like to talk about a fairy tale, like is to kind of imbue a story with magical powers which can take it into any direction you want. So it was like that.
There's
idea of trying
to
contain
fairy tales, yeah.
Something that was uncontainable.
Yeah, we never actually used traditional fairy tales, but we kind of invent our own. But like, I think that there's something extraordinary about the oral tradition, the spoken word, the kind of the things that cultures and communities need to be able to navigate moral kind of treacherous
problems.
Ground. You
yeah.
know, like I think
yeah.
then there's I love the way that when you're in a fairy tale as a child, like whether you're being read to or reading it yourself, or you're even just watching something or whatever, you are mapping your consciousness onto whichever character you feel like mapping onto at that moment. So you could be like, you know, cross gender. You could be like, I feel like being the baddie today, so I feel like being the witch or the
you could be the tortoise
or the giant,
and
what you're doing is you're kind of you're building empathy towards what that feels like to be that character, and you're exploring all the different sides of yourself, including the you know, we have kind of dark, violent, kind of aggressive sides to us, which can only be explored when you're in a sort of the safe space of a story. If you explore
it's allowed.
I was just thinking, cathartic, isn't it?
I was just thinking when I was a little kid, I'm the eldest of seven and an Irish family, and when we go to bed at night, I used to tell my brothers and sisters a story. And I'd make a story up every night.
Yeah.
I'd go to bed, they'd say, Michael, tell us a story. So they say, right, get ready. All get in there. And I was like the eldest, and off I'd go, and I'd start talking about Prince Rupert and the van. There'd be this prince, and he'd have like this big white van full of straw. Because it was nice and warm, and there'd be like snowing outside. And we'd all be in this little van, you know, getting nice and warm, and there'd be biscuits in there, and bread, and jam, and stuff. And then we're thinking, where are we going to go? We're going to go to Seacroft, and we'll go to Skegness.
Yeah.
And I'd tell a story, and then, of course, we'd hit some...
there'd
be wolves, you know, on the road. Oh no, what will we do? I'll get the sword out. And then they'd be dropping off one by one. You know, there's Jerry had gone. But then the next night they said, oh, will you tell us a story? So every night I'd make a story. And I found that I had a facility for that. For telling stories.
So did you put your siblings into the story? Did you kind of like...
I don't remember. But every night, and when I became a dad, basically my kids, I'd tell them a story every night. And they'd say, tell us a story. And I'd say, right, okay, the table that danced. If you leave it, put some music on it. It only danced to punk music. And then they say, oh, no, tell us a story about the table. I said, no, it's a new story tonight. Tonight, the story, you know, it's Flossie the deer. the deer with depression or something, you know.
No idea.
So, you know, and...
And it's very amazing when you're in that live storytelling space where you're inventing it and you don't know where it's going, and it could go anywhere, and somehow it kind of gets to a place where you wanted it to be, and
you've no idea how you got
there.
Someone
told me a really great thing about how to do improvised storytelling where you kind of involve the audience, because we did quite a lot of that in House Fairy Tales, and it's like you have to tell the story walking backwards. And so you put down clues in your story, like objects or place names or markers or of some kind, or characters or whatever. And because you're walking backwards, you can see what you put down, and then you can bring them into the future, and you can bring them into the next, and you can kind of create like a magical act. Like, how did that happen? You've just tied it all together.
Yeah, yeah.
And because the audience is only seeing forwards, they're not looking backwards.
But there is something about the very sort of like reassuring about the fact that there is stories, because it's just something that's it's like a balm, a medicine for us all. Mm. You know, in all of the hell of life, mm. There's a story is such a wonderful elixir. It's just something there to, oh God, I can have a story, and if it's either you read or. I can remember my dad telling me stories and my mother, and my dad was a musician. He played six instruments. He played pipes and the Aeolian pipes, the Irish pipes and the concert flute and the accordion. And he was, but he'd have stories, you know, and stories about work. He'd talk about work and he'd talk about, and about sort of the tricks he'd play on his workmates in the cabin, you know, because he was a labourer. He'd just shovel concrete. And so we'd put a hot spoon on a chair. Then somebody come and sit there, a hot tea bag, sleep on the chair, and then somebody come in and sit there, or heat a spoon and then just put it on the table, and then somebody goes to get it to, you know, to put it, oh, fuck. And it'd be lots of that kind of stuff. But they're kind of a distraction from the kind of the angst of what's going on around you. And a good story will get you through a day.
Mm.
Because you're still laughing at it, sort of like maybe 6 or 7 hours late, you think, oh, you know, oh, that was, it's a good part of the day. It's like having a bun, you know. And I'm so pleased that we have stories in our life, because it's a part of the armament of just getting through.
But what we need to do now, where we're at now, is that where we've always, drawn on the wellspring of stories from the fantasy world and from the world of invention, and that kind of brings in some parts of the actual world with around you, but you know, a bit like your prince who's driving the van to Skegness. Like where we've got to is, like, humans have got this extraordinary capacity for imagination, and at the moment and we're very good at building what we imagine. You know, if someone kind of comes up with the idea of a computer. You know, like it happens in this kind of imagination space, and then and then you enroll other people in your imagination space, and before you know it, they're working with you to create these things. And at the moment, we're imagining en masse as human beings is a kind of a future which is looking darker and more ominous by the second. And what we need to do is to bring the wellspring of stories and playful kind of curiosity and excitement into the stories of the future, and look at how we can imagine the future in a more positive and more kind of possible way. And if we can see the possibility of the future, we might actually stand a chance of making it, rather than sleepwalking into this kind of.
That's quite profound. Yeah. If you can imagine it, then
if you can imagine it, you can make it.
Yeah.
And if we build, if we dream, as individuals, I mean, like kind of, you know, as a collective imagination. And at the moment, the collective imagination, especially because we've got these kind of leaders who just give us all that dystopia all the time, or even just boring, you know, just kind of like, yeah, it can't be done. Oh, it's like, you know, business as usual. You know, it's like
these are the adults in the room, and it's so they're so loathsome and so they have no kind of positive qualities, and it's a case of, well, we have to do it. We have to be the adults in our own lives. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to kind of really be careful our kids and for each other. And
but everybody needs to be their own leader.
There is a sense, in a strange way, it's been quite sort of liberating. It's given us all a sort of sense that, well, I can't rely on those above us are stupid. I'll have to do something. I'll have to look out for myself.
In
a way, that's sometimes what we need. We have to just man up, person up.
Yeah.
Jump up and dance. You
didn't get very far through your questions, did you?
Doesn't matter. Have we done an hour? Possibly. Have we done half an hour? Recommended... Oh, yeah, all right, so I've got here recommended lockdown artist that seems relevant at this time, and I've written, you know, Eric Dolphy, Chili Gonzalez, and Who are you listening to at the moment that's kind of getting you through, or you're reading that's sort of it's a go-to book or like a...
I've done a lot of reading. I've been reading a lot of different things, actually. I mean, I did a lot of reading. In the beginning, I was reading a lot about the environment. So I was reading that Isabella Tree Wilding, and I read Feral by George Monbiot.
Yep.
And so I was sort of looking at this whole idea of almost like not farming, like the opposite of that. And I read a few things about like the way that agriculture is killing soil and killing the land. My daughter also has been heavily involved in a project called Repeat, which is about trying to save, restore and or kind of protect peatlands and marshlands, wetlands, bogs.
Which are as important and, to the environment as rainforests.
Yeah, basically, like they only take up 3% of the land, 3% of the land mass on the planet, but something like 30% of the carbon capture. So they're really, really good. They're better than a rainforest.
We're still subsidising farmers in
to drain peatlands.
And when they drain them, they turn into the dragon, like the Jekyll and Hyde. Like they kind of they release vast quantities of carbon into the atmosphere, and somehow the awareness hasn't got through to people that kind of that. So
that's come on strong, and they did this thing called Peat Fest during the lockdown, and that was 24 hours of conversations, talks, webinars, poems, like all sorts of stuff, and it went on, and it started in New Zealand, like right early in the morning of the day, and it went all the way around, sort of ending up in like LA, or you know, it sort of went round the world.
Canada.
So it went round the world in peat. So around the clock, 24 hours of peat.
And it gathered a whole Peat Fest, movement of young people.
It was crazy.
24 hours of peat.
24 hours of peat.
So Sam Lee and the Nightingales was a high point for me. He was on the Peat Fest, actually. That was rather good.
Yeah. Like, the band, you mean?
No, Sam Lee. You know Sam Lee?
The folk
He's
singer.
A folk singer.
No, I don't.
He's a song collector.
I read his book as well, The Nightingales.
He goes around collecting songs from travelling communities and stuff.
And every year,
in May, he goes out and he takes people on walks into the woods and finds the nightingales and actually kind of sings to the nightingales or plays instruments to the nightingales, and they do a call and response thing because the nightingales are sort of like amazing birds.
Yeah.
And because he wasn't able to do that publicly this year, he did a kind of online version of singing with nightingales. So every night for this period in May, you could go online at a certain time, and he'd take you on a walk into the woods, and he'd have guest artists and guest performers, including Gavin, and there would be like kind of these moments of thinking about nature and thinking about ecosystems and environments, and with the backdrop of this extraordinary bird that has very mythical fairy tale qualities.
Yeah. And it's got an I instead of an E in the middle. I always spell it, I used to write Nightingale, but it's Nightingale, it's an I-N-G-I-N-G.
Don't suppose it. The bird minds.
The bird won't. You just spell it in the old way.
And then we quite enjoyed the philosophy lectures at the having a drink with the idler.
Yeah. And we saw you. We went to your beekeeper guy. Who's the guy?
Bill. Yeah,
Bill. Yeah, Bill Anderson. Yeah. Bill Anderson. The bee. The idler.
Yeah, I'm
bee
seeing
keeper.
Him this afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's on the podcast now. So, and then after my kind of environmental series of books, I read the Sam Lee book about the nightingale as well, and then I got more into Black Lives Matter. I read Natives by Akala, which is great, really pacey book. That's a good read. At the moment I'm reading Can't Stop, Won't Stop, The History of Hip-Hop.
Right.
Jeff Chatton is like a 2005 kind of like little classic interviews with all of the main proponents of of the hip hop scene, all that kind of like the, or like laying it out with the whole kind of Jamaican scene, and then the Bronx gangs that then turn into these sound systems, Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa, and like the way that they kind of like break up the gang scene, and the gang scene then sort of like turns into this kind of music scene. And then weirdly enough, obviously, like the Rapper's Delight, the first hip hop record was like a kind of a quango record made with people who were kind of put together by a record company. And everyone's like, what the hell is this? But actually, obviously, it's now the stuff of legend. You know, the Sugar Hill Gang, like, you know, it's like they were there. They put it on a record because they, you know, before that, it wasn't anything you could put on a record. It was like records were like, you know, Grandmaster Flash was like saying, get away from me. You know, I don't want to make a record. It's not about a record. It's about the live set. It's about like, you know, it's about like being there. It's about like playing around with the records, having some, you know, MCs chatting in front of the records, and they're in, out, they're in, out. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. You know, change the record, flip, flip, flip. It was all about the live thing. It could go wrong, could blow up, could fizz, you know, like they plug into the streetlights. Yeah. And like sometimes it just went,
so the system went down. Suddenly it was like kind of.
And now they're making records. Yeah. And the first record, obviously, Rapper's Delight, I think, is like, you know, it's like 20 minutes, and they're going like, 20 minutes, like they managed to get a whole night put into 20 minutes. Wow, it's just not long enough. And which is really long at the time for any recorded record. And then they, you know, they managed to get it down to 3 minutes. You know, that's it. It goes into 3 minutes.
And it gets, like, you know. And it's on, and it's kind of part of most people's wedding parties, and you get so, people's 50th. Oh, yeah, just, yeah, we'll have, can we have Rapper's Delight, and can we have, what's the other one?
The
gold,
message.
Gold digger. We'll have gold digger.
Someone said to me, like, their party, that this is a party in the middle of a field, and the police came to close it down and said, you've got to turn it off now. Have you got the message? And he said, yes, it's in my hand. And he puts it down, starts it up. And he says, well, no, after this, this is the message.
It's quite an important moment to mention that our friend Sally's publishing a book about the music industry and mental health. And she's very experienced in the music industry. And she's sort of talking, this book is unpacking the relationship between the kind of the highly capitalist sort of like consumerist side of the record industry, where you've got to be, you know, there's a whole kind of thing which makes people inauthentic and lose their playful side and have to be in their kind of professional
guarded product side all the time.
And how that relates to, you know, the amount of you know, drug abuse in people who you feel like, why, you know, you've got everything, what's the problem, all the way through the system. I think that is probably a pertinent book to also
drop,
reflect on, like in your kind of conversation about how to commercialize and capitalize on a street scene.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like again, like if you know, going full circle, coming back to like pulling down sculptures or putting up graffiti, you know, graffiti writing, and how, and I mean, we just before lockdown, you know, we did, and we are probably in a moment where, you know, you've got street artists, urban artists, people that write on walls, actually like coming into auction houses and being part of the art world in a really like high value way, you know, that, you know, an artist, there was like at the moment or like just at the end of last year, there was an artist called Kaws, K-A-W-S. I mean, like, this was a street artist in America, but, you know, recent, a young guy, you know, young, he's really young, younger than me anyway. And, you know, and he's got these £1 million price tags of stuff that I'm not really getting. You know, I'm not really sure like how it works, but they kind of they seem to have the legacy of urban or street art behind them. And this is a credibility factor. This is a way that it works, which is totally spun on its head because, you know, obviously when graffiti writing starts, you know, there's a battle. It's criminal. Yeah, it's criminal. A lot of those early street writers, they did time in prison for going out and painting trains and stuff. They got put in prison for it. You know, so it's just quite interesting the way that all these things spin around and like somehow like what's one minute's inside, the next minute's outside, you know, and those changes, those cultural shifts of what we think is important and how we understand ourselves in relationship to that. But again, it's our context conversation. You know, how do we take first of all baby steps, but then bigger steps to do something great? How do we do the right thing? What is the right thing? Do the right thing.
I've just realised we completely forgot that we were supposed to be doing our family yoga right now. So all through lockdown, we've been doing a weekly yoga thing on Zoom.
I wasn't going to talk about yoga.
Children.
Because the yoga had been...
Like with our son in Canada and our daughter in Amsterdam and with Hattie. Oh, I'm now recording that.
It's been doubly recorded. Yes, so that's totally thrown me now. I'm not supposed to be doing a podcast now. I'm supposed to be doing yoga.
All right.
And I did talk to you about the possibility that my yoga would have finished, and then I said to you, it's okay, I'm not doing yoga today. But now, apparently, supposed to be doing yoga. Yeah. There's a lot of... What we're finding in lockdown is there's a lot of yoga that's happening, that then's not happening, that then's happening, then it's not happening, and now it's happening.
All right, yeah. And it is happening. Yoga's happening in lockdown, in happening.
Yeah.
Because I started to do Pilates about 6 weeks ago, and I'd never done Pilates. Well, my partner, she's done it 22 years, and because like there's no classes, she's now doing it on Zoom.
Yeah.
And then 6 weeks ago, she was in the telly room. She said, "Mick, do you want to come and do?" And I just pulled some shorts on. I got in there.
But this is the accessibility of the online thing.
Yeah.
Like I think there is something, although it's got a load of dark side and horribleness about the way that we're all glued to our screens and we're all turning into cyborgs. I think there is something about the accessibility of things. the fact that you two are doing yoga and Pilates where you weren't before is quite
no. I mean, I would have sniffed at it, you know, kind of like 2 months ago. But basically, I need somebody to get me through, and this is getting me through. And I'm actually quite surprised at how fit I feel. I'm doing it twice a week. And it just makes
you feel better.
My back feels all right, and my shoulders feel okay, and I feel good. Yeah. So it's a bonus, and it's so never say never, as it were.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much. And with all our guests, do you have a recommended album of the week, the pair of you? Now, Deborah, have you got an album of the week that we should be listening to?
I'm going to have to say Jarvis's new album. Because it's just come out and he's been doing his Saturday night disco all through lockdown, which somehow I only just found out about, so I'm a bit disappointed about that. But I'm very excited to be doing it in my own time.
And what's the name of the album?
I think it's called Jarve Is.
Excellent. And what's your album, Gavin?
My album is... I didn't know you were going to ask me this, and obviously with these things sometimes like your mind, I think you did well to answer it, because sometimes like you're listening to stuff all the time but your mind just goes blank. The last person I searched for on Spotify was David Axelrod. But I don't know why.
Thanks to Gavin Turk and Deborah Curtis for coming on the Ego Podcast, and thanks to you listeners for tuning in. Gavin is drawing every day during lockdown, and Deborah continues to work on her project, The Great Imagining. For further details, you can go to the website gavinturk.com and houseoffairytales.org, Twitter at Gavin Turk, Instagram, This Is Not Gavin Turk. And you can listen to this again and download this podcast on iTunes, Mick Artistic's Ego Podcast. Further links can be found on our website, mickartistic.com. See you on the road and on the waves next time. Bye.
Ego Podcast.